letter of the law, and the spirit of the law, right? Sometimes occasions may arise in which observing the letter of the law would violate its spirit. Okay? In other words, where keeping the law would not serve the purpose of the law, okay, which we saw was ultimately the salvation of souls. Okay? And how is this possible? Well, it's simply possible because the lawgiver, right, the Pope, the Church, can only make laws that apply in general. I mean, no Pope can possibly envision and make law for every possible circumstance, for every possible case, right? That's only reasonable. So, and that's really the case for everything, civil law as well. You can only make laws generally. So what happens if an occasion arises, a scenario arises where really, yeah, keeping the letter of the law would be totally contrary to its spirit? And the church, again, is very reasonable and very merciful. And we can invoke here a principle, what the church calls the principle of epikaia, which basically means equity or fairness. What is it? Epikaia is the interpretation of the mind and the will of the legislator, okay, the lawgiver, right, the Pope, basically. And epikaia looks at, okay, what did the legislator intend in making a particular law? What was the point in making this law? Remember, we saw that the church doesn't just make laws. The church makes laws for a particular reason, to order the conduct of her members for the common good, and ultimately to help save as many souls as possible. That's the point of why there is a law. So we need to remember what the legislator intended in making a particular law, and we need to remember that, of course, the spirit of the law, in other words, the purpose of the law, is superior to the letter of the law. That is what epikaia is, basically. I'm simplifying it. Now, epikaia, excuse me, can be impermissible in a certain case. It can be permissible, and it can even be obligatory in a particular case. All right? For example, take the case of, we'll use a very simple example. Mother is alone with her children at home, and they're all small children. Well, let's say 10 and younger. And she says, I'm going to have to go run to the store. I'll be back in 15 minutes. Children, don't leave the house. So she goes, and she goes to the store, and a fire breaks out in the house. What are the children supposed to do? No, Mommy said we can't leave the house. Well, of course, the mother wasn't foreseeing that circumstance, right? Mother doesn't want her children to stay in the house and burn to death, okay? Of course, the mother would want the letter of her law to be, in this case, disobeyed, and she wants her children to be safe, and obviously, the children would have to leave the house, okay? The mother would want the children to disobey because that's not the point of her law of not leaving the house. That's not why she told them that. It's not so that they would be hurt, but so that they would be safe, right? Oh, very much common sense. So, again, this law of the children can't leave the house was meant to apply in general. It was not meant to apply when there is an unforeseen circumstance justifying the children leaving the house. Okay, and this is what we mean by epikaia. Common sense. Look at what the law was intended to do, and if there's a conflict between the purpose of the law and the letter of the law, by all means, the spirit of the law is superior to the letter. And we can see this in the gospel, for example. Our Lord rebuked the Pharisees for clinging to the letter of the law against and to the detriment of its spirit. And you know, this was in the context of keeping versus violating the Sabbath. in chapter 2 of St. Mark's Gospel. And our Lord said, Sabbath, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. And likewise, the law of the church was made for souls. Souls were not made for the law. So just to stay with that example of the Sabbath rest, we can, we must violate the Sunday rest sometimes to help a neighbor in grave need, okay? We can't say, oh, sorry, no, it's Sunday, I can't do servile work, sorry, you're going to have to suffer, can't help you there. That would be sinful, and that is not what the Sunday rest is for, okay? Where, I mean, that would be totally contrary to the gospel. So that's a great example of where we must act contrary to the letter of the law in order to uphold its spirit, to uphold the purpose for why the law exists in the first place. Now, we've gone through it. We've covered a lot here. It's time we took this Epikaya business that I just talked about, and let's apply it to the two consecrations. Let's see what we get here. I think we can all agree that in 1981, there was an urgent need in the world to have sede vacantes bishops. Can we all agree on that? Believe it or not, I've had a friend of mine in Cincinnati dispute that one. If somebody wants to dispute that, we'll take it outside. No, we'll have a separate discussion on that. I'm sorry, but it's simply absurd to suggest that in 1981 there was no need for sede vacantes bishops. Okay? It's simply, I think it's silly, it's absurd. But we can talk about that. Why was there an urgent need? Well, for one thing, to perpetuate the sacraments, and to perpetuate the apostolic succession, at least materially. All right, that's why we had a need then, and you know, still do now, but it's certainly not as grave and urgent as it was 30 years ago. Now, here comes the first problem. The bishop took, of course, did not have the necessary authorization from the Holy See to consecrate bishops because Holy See was vacant. All right, and according to Canon 953, you need a papal mandate before you can consecrate a bishop. Okay, you need the authorization from the Pope to go, before you can go ahead and consecrate a bishop. Then we have a second problem, and that is, Bishop Took might have been, and I say might because I'm certainly not competent to resolve the controversy, and thankfully I don't need to, but let's just say he might have been under excommunication or suspension for having previously consecrated objectively unworthy men to the episcopacy. Okay, for example, clergy in the Palmer de Troia group, Jean Labourie, and others. And we don't need to go into, you know, who did he consecrate and did he really? And you know, all of a sudden you have a whole list of names and a whole list of claims that, you know, everybody says, oh yeah, I was consecrated by Bishop Took, and you know, I was too. And in any case, let's just say, yes, he consecrated the wrong men. He did, okay? At least some, and let us just assume, because we want to be on the safe side here, okay? I didn't want to argue anything that I would have to later maybe say, oh, gee, you know, maybe I was wrong about him not being excommunicated, and now my whole argument, you know, falls down like a house of cards. I said, I'm going to assume, at least for the sake of argument, that he was excommunicated, because that's the worst thing that could have happened, right? If it was still okay, if it's still lawful for Bishop Took to consecrate Bishops Carmona, Zamora, and De Laurier, even if he was under excommunication, then all the better. So let's just say that Bishop Took might have been under excommunication or suspension for having consecrated the wrong people, and therefore, of course, without the presumed papal permission. Obviously, no pope would give permission to consecrate somebody who's not worthy to be consecrated. Okay, so we couldn't even presume a papal permission. This goes back to canons 2370 and the decree from the Holy Office of April 9th, 1951. And this is all explained at great length in my study. Okay, so these are two problems, okay, that we're looking at. Maybe Bishop Tuck was excommunicated, and in any case, he didn't have papal authorization, as is required by the Church's law to consecrate these three bishops in 1981. However, the salvation and good of souls demanded the consecration of Sede Vacantis bishops, didn't it? So, how are we going to resolve this conundrum now? The fact of the matter is that Bishop Tuck, at the time in 1981, was the only bishop, at least as far as I know, the only bishop professing the Roman Catholic faith and willing to consecrate Sede Vacantis bishops. Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre was not willing to consecrate Sede Vacantis. Bishop de Castromeyer was not willing to consecrate Sede Vacantis. Bishop Blaise Kurtz, who was a German missionary bishop in China, was already deceased as of 1973. He might have been willing to do it, but he was already dead. And Bishop Alfred Mendez, and that's the bishop the Society of St. Pius V used for to consecrate Bishop Kelly. I'm sorry, but he also was not willing to consecrate Sede Vacantis in 1981. In fact, just 3 years earlier, he was still involved with the Novus Ordo, serving as a co-consecrator in 1978, making modernist bishops. Okay? Now, I'm not trying to bash Bishop Mendez, but it is a fact. Okay, that is the public record, and it's got to be fair game, right? If the public record is fair game for Bishop Tuck, it has to be fair game for Bishop Mendez. And I know that that was the case, that he co-consecrated two modernists for the Novus Ordo Church in Oregon in 1978, because I have a photocopy of the diocesan newspaper article. And I even spoke by email with one of the bishops, Bishop Mendez, co-consecrated. And he explained to me why Bishop Mendez had been chosen, because I think one of the other consecrants was also a Holy Cross father like Bishop Mendez. And the bishop, the Novus Ordo bishop that I contacted was Bishop, I think his name is Kenneth Steiner. He was one of the two ordinance, and the other one was Paul Waldschmidt, who is already deceased. So there's no question, yes, Bishop Mendez did in fact still participate in the Novus Ordo, making bishops for the Novus Ordo Church as late as 1978, so you can understand that in 1981 he wasn't around either to consecrate Sede Vacantis. And I'm not trying to find fault with him. We've all had our journey out of the Novus Ordo. I mean, not all of us, but many, certainly myself, and I'm not his judge, and I'm not trying to, you know, to say he should have known better. It's not my place. I just wanted to point out that he was not available to consecrate Sede Vacantis either. Now, in keeping with the spirit of the law, the spirit, mind you, not so much the letter, but in keeping with the spirit of the law, to receive consecration from Bishop Tuck, I submit. And anybody's free to critique this, but I believe it's very reasonable that it was at least permissible in this case, the 1981 consecrations, to act contrary to church law, okay? To consecrate without the papal mandate, to consecrate even if Bishop Tuck was under excommunication, okay? At least permissible for Bishop Tuck to consecrate Carmona, Zamora, and De Laurier. Possibly, it may have been actually morally obligatory, maybe even necessary in this case, to act contrary to church law. Why? In order to uphold the purpose for which the law exists. right? The salvation of souls. I mean, that's what the church's law is all about. So I'm saying it was definitely permissible for Bishop Tuck to consecrate these men and for these men to be consecrated by him, perhaps even necessary. And again, the reason being that the divine law, remember how a few minutes ago we distinguished divine law from human law? The divine law of the salvation of souls, that is the highest law, that is the reason why all church law exists, certainly trumps the human church law, which, let's face it, did not foresee the circumstance, and whose purpose it is to serve the divine law. Certainly when Pope Benedict XV in 1917 was promulgating the code of canon law, he wasn't thinking of a complete apostasy, basically, from the faith, and of a false Novus Ordo church eclipsing the true church and the people left in utter confusion and chaos and not knowing what to do, and almost everybody practically losing the faith. Obviously, that was not something that the Pope foresaw. And so the human church law, which says you need a papal mandate, you cannot be under excommunication and all of that, this has to be set aside for the higher law, the divine law of saving souls. Okay? It's only reasonable. Again, it's like the children, otherwise like the children staying in the house because they want to obey their mother to the letter, when obviously the mother only wants is only concerned about the safety of her children. All right, so in other words, Pope Pius XII, he was the one who instituted an excommunication for unlawful episcopal consecrations. For episcopal consecrations that are done without the explicit permission of the Holy See. Pope Pius XII did not foresee the situation we are in now, and neither did Pope Benedict XV, who promulgated the Code of Canon Law. Let us now make the same point by assuming the contrary, okay? Let's assume for a minute that the two consecrations were not permissible. Okay, that Bishop Tuck was excommunicated, and no, it wasn't right for him to consecrate these men bishops in 1981. If we assume that for the moment, we have to admit that it leads to all sorts of absurd scenarios. In order to hold the position that Bishop Tuck was not permitted to consecrate Bishops Carmona, Zamora, and Delorier, we would have to imagine a whole list of things. We would have to imagine that God would not want the Sedevacantist remnant to have bishops and sacraments because of one bishop's misdeeds. Because Bishop Tuck consecrated the wrong men in 1976, or, you know, because he made mistakes, or he was careless or negligent. And by the way, I'm saying this for the sake of argument. I'm not saying one way or another on this. So we would have to assume, we would have to imagine that God would not want his faithful remnant to have bishops, to have priests, to have sacraments, simply because Bishop Tuck did something wrong. We would further have to imagine that God would want the innocent faithful to go without countless sacramental graces because of a penalty, excommunication, suspension, whose purpose it was, remember the medicinal thing? Whose purpose it was to bring Bishop Tuck to his senses. Remember that? We said the medicinal penalty is medicine. And then excommunication and a suspension is a medicinal penalty. Its purpose is to bring the offender back to his senses. See, we would have to imagine that God would want the innocent faithful who have really nothing to do with Bishop Tuck's misdeeds or alleged misdeeds. God would want the innocent faithful to go without all these countless sacramental graces because of a penalty that the church instituted to bring Bishop Tuck to his senses. We would have to imagine that if we wanted to say that the Tuck consecrations were not permissible. Next, we would have to believe that God would want Bishop Took's assumed excommunication to stand in the way of the salvation of souls. Because think about it, who really, in the end, suffers? If this was not permissible, who suffers? Not Bishop Took, right? It will be us. It will be the faithful remnant. It will be all those souls that have converted to the faith and have received graces and so forth, have had their sins forgiven. They would be the ones suffering, really. So we would have to imagine that God would want this excommunication to be a stumbling block to the salvation of souls. Furthermore, we would have to imagine that the Pope would want his own changeable human law to trump facilitating the salvation of souls. Right? We would have to imagine that the Pope, Pope Pius XII, for example, would stand there and say, nope, doesn't matter. I don't care if those people go to hell. I don't care if they have mass. I don't care if they have priests. My law rules. Okay? No, that's not what the church's law is for. Next, we would have to imagine that the church's law would exist for its own sake and not to help souls. It's absurd. And finally, we would basically have to imagine that the church's law trumps the divine law, right? The salvation of souls. We would have to imagine all these things if we wanted to say that Bishop Took was not permitted to consecrate Bishops Carmona Zamora and De Laurier. Obviously, this is all unreasonable and contrary to the purpose of the church and the gospel. So the burden of proof really is now on those who would say otherwise, assuming Bishop Took was under excommunication or suspension to begin with. And that's something, like I said, in my study, I simply presumed, I wanted to presume the worst, because then I figured I'd have all my bases covered, okay? I'm not a canon lawyer, okay, obviously, and I'm not going to get into, you know, these arguments about, you know, was he excommunicated? Well, was he not? Is a doubtful excommunication? I don't know, okay, and I'm not willing to stake, you know, a whole argument on something that in the end might turn out to be wrong. So I wanted to be on the safe side and simply assume the worst case scenario, that he was excommunicated. And finally, I would submit this. If acting contrary, if violating the letter of the law to uphold the Spirit isn't permissible in this case, well, when is it? Right? When is it ever permitted to violate the letter of the law to uphold the Spirit, if not now? When, you know, we're, especially in 1981, when it was just looking very bleak, because, yes, you had set of Aconis priests, but no bishops. So that's another important consideration. Next, I'd like to talk about receiving the sacraments from excommunicates, because this is really very important. Canon 2261, paragraph 2 of the Church's law says, the faithful can, for any just cause, seek the sacraments and sacramentals from one excommunicated, especially if other ministers are lacking. Okay, that's pretty clear. Now, this certainly shows the church's reasonableness, her leniency, and her mercy towards the faithful. It shows that the church seeks to remove unnecessary obstacles in the way of salvation. Right? The church does not seek to punish the faithful for the misdeeds of her clergy. So that is a very consoling thing. Canon 2261, the faithful can, for any just cause, seek the sacraments and sacramentals from one who is excommunicated, especially, but not only, but especially, if other ministers are lacking. Now, I wanted to show you here a quote from Father Francis Highland. He wrote a book in 1928 called Excommunication, Its Nature, Historical Development, and Effects. And this is a very important point, and I think one that is very consoling to all of us. And Father Hyland says, the solicitude of the church that the spiritual welfare of the faithful be not impeded by the malice of those to whom she has committed the dispensation of her spiritual benefits is manifested in paragraph 2 and paragraph 3 of Canon 2261, what I just quoted. All right? So this proves what I was just saying, that the church is solicitous for the spiritual welfare of her children, and she does not want to see that spiritual good impeded by the malice of basically her ministers. You know, if they should be guilty of an offense that results in excommunication, she doesn't want the faithful to suffer because of this. And that is the reason why the church says, no, the faithful can still seek the sacraments and the sacramentals from those who are excommunicated. Okay, now I'm simplifying it a little bit, but that's essentially the true picture. Now, it's also important. A few years ago, I kind of thought that excommunication was the same thing as schism, and so I wanted to make that point. It's not true, okay? Excommunication is not the same thing as schism. Somebody who is excommunicated is not thereby a schismatic. And this becomes clear when we look at the definition. An excommunication, you remember, is a medicinal punishment that deprives the one excommunicated from certain spiritual goods and benefits, right? He cannot go to mass and so forth, okay? It's a medicinal punishment on a person. Schism, on the other hand, is the refusal of communion with the Roman pontiff or with the faithful who are subject to the Roman pontiff. So excommunicates can be schismatic if they refuse communion with the Roman pontiff or the faithful. And all schismatics are excommunicated by the church's law, but excommunication is not the same thing as schism. And at this point, we've pretty much covered it all. How are we doing? Still with me? All right. I wanted to specifically address now some objections from the Society of St. Pius V and others.